Returning to the Daily Audio Stash is our good friend Dr. Mitch Earlywine, who's Associate Professor of Psychology at the State University of New York at Albany, who joins us every Wednesday here on the Daily Audio Stash. Dr. Earlywine, welcome back.
Oh, I love being on the show.
We had ourselves, and it's a happy 420 week to you as well.
Oh, and thanks so much, and same to you.
We had this story that was quite alarming from last week's stash, and I thought I'd hold off on talking more about this until I got a chance to run it by you. But it was about this story coming out of Germany where they were finding lead flakes in some people's marijuana stashes. Presumably the dealers were adding lead to make the marijuana weigh more so they could make more money off of it. And is this the first time you've heard of something like this? And what can people how can people prevent this from happening?
I was really suspicious when I first heard about this story, but there was a letter to the editor in the New England Journal of Medicine suggesting that a number of patients in Germany now, not here in the States, had come in with lead poisoning and, in fact, had been regular cannabis users. And when you look closely at the data that they present, these are folks with 10 to 20 times the amount of lead in their blood that they're normally supposed to have. So seriously, they had genuine lead poisoning. This was not just some crazy government cover-up like the old 1970s Paraquat stories we used to hear, and I'm happy to get into that as well. When you take a close look at the pictures they provide, there actually are lead flakes in the bottom of the bag. It looked like it may have been something as simple as somebody just throwing a little bit of lead in the bottom of a bag, but then there was another picture that suggested perhaps someone had sprayed really small flecks of lead all throughout the bag. And obviously, on a single gram, this isn't going to have that much of an impact. But if you're selling, large amounts, this does in fact add up over a time. This is probably one of the most frightening ones of these I've heard in the last 30 years. And I originally thought maybe this was some kind of anti-drug alarmist craziness. But when you see these blood draws and these blood levels reported, I really do trust these data. Obviously, what people need to do is take a close look in their baggies and make sure there isn't, some fishing line weight hanging out in the bottom. But also, is there any strange discoloration, any curious metallic look to the cannabis, which of course would be, extremely suspicious and just horrible. But also, if they have any strange feelings in reaction to the cannabis, then again, also you want to go ahead to emergency medicine. But all in all, I haven't seen a case of this yet reported in the United States. I certainly hope dealers here wouldn't, stoop to anything so low. But man, oh man, do we need a taxed and regulated market when we start hearing stories like this. Clearly, if there was any kind of supervision or way for folks to have cannabis approved and for, open sale to adults across the nation, we could certainly sidestep what is by far the most poisonous metallic issue of all, lead. It's just a mind blower.
What are some of the things people would notice symptom-wise if they had gotten some of this lead-tainted marijuana?
The spooky thing about this is they may not notice anything right away, and then suddenly, literally, people who are just smoking, a couple of times a week, it might take 30 days for them to suddenly notice all kinds of strange fatigue, neuropathic pain, strange feelings in the limbs and in the arms and legs and things like that, and just a real incredible difficulty in breathing or strange things along those lines, depending on how severe the poisoning is. I hesitate to even pretend like, this is something people can just sort of diagnose on their own. It's just such a crazy predicament and something that, obviously, staying away from the cannabis that originated the problem is, of course, a big issue, but there are really strong, really important medications that can undo lead poisoning, and that's a hard thing to even have to think about, but something that has to be dealt with, pretty early on. Oftentimes, when folks go in, it's something as simple as headache or insomnia, and they'll get questions about, do you have a lot of body piercings, or do you work around lead paint, or something along those lines? So if you are using cannabis and experience some of these symptoms, take your cannabis with you so that they can try to identify if that's necessarily the source.
Now, would anyone notice a difference in smell or taste if they were stuck with some of this marijuana?
What's curious curious is there's actually little lead flakes in the bottom of the bags that they show in the study. So if you're shaking your, you've got strong buds there that are pretty firm, and you grind them up and you notice metallic pieces falling out, that's, of course, the most outrageous telltale sign. And it's funny how something as simple as a magnifying glass could make all the difference, so that it's not something that is the same color as, say, the glands or the green parts of the plant. It really is that lead gray color, and something that would be pretty obvious once you got it under the light with a decent magnifying glass.
But other than visually, you don't suspect there's a way to taste or smell it.
It seems like getting it to even burn would be cumbersome and hard to detect in a reliable way. So I can't imagine that would be a reliable way to experience it. The other problem, of course, is that there is such a thing as lead intoxication, and so people do experience this crazy dizziness and sort of something akin to loss of consciousness, but that usually means the dose is incredibly high, and if that accompanies a headache, that's a pretty strong sign that blood lead levels are getting way too high.
Now, this is not the only adulterant that we would have encountered in cannabis studies throughout the years. You mentioned the paraquat from the 70s, and it seems like this adulterant here has to do with trying to increase profits by making the marijuana weigh more. What other sort of adulterants would people have to worry about in a black market cannabis system?
It's scary to think about, but in fact, people who don't actually have real cannabis have heard certain legends about, oh, add this or add that to some other green matter and sort of hope for the best, and that people will be intoxicated from these other substances. Those tend to be urban legends. Those aren't actually showing up in confiscated cannabis, at least in most of the studies that have been done from the labs down in Mississippi, for example. The paraquat issue was one of an herbicide that was sprayed around in fields primarily in Mexico in the 1970s that was designed to essentially just kill all the plants in these large Mexican fields. And there were even some areas in Georgia and Kentucky that had also been sprayed. This is a horrible habit because this is an herbicide that is extremely toxic even at low doses. And anytime you spray anything into the air, of course it's going to spread around and have the potential to harm people, livestock, and other crops. And Keith Stroop was, in fact, incredibly outspoken about this and did a lot, I think, to get that ended in the 1970s. Most of our listeners probably don't remember this, and I was actually in grade school at the time, but remember hearing a big outcry, and this got a lot of marijuana smokers activated nationwide to say, you know, this is another example of how, you know, the drug war is basically a war on a certain subculture of the population, and this is completely unfair and got people really motivated. As it turns out, paraquat pyrolyzes, meaning once it's lit on fire, it actually is destroyed, and it wasn't toxic, and it wasn't going to create the negative consequences that we all feared, but it still seemed like such a horrible thing to have to absorb in your respiratory tract, and so it was nice that everybody rallied around and got that put to an end at the time, but I feel like this is in the back pocket of DEA agents and other folks who are against larger cannabis crops, and something we just want to keep in mind again. There were, at least in the 70s, these paraquat testing kits that were for sale almost immediately as soon as it hit the news, and in fact those were completely ineffective and just a scam, which is another sad thing about how here, because we're in a subculture that essentially relies on an underground market, we are victim of other things that are also going to basically play on that market. So I feel like the paraquat issue is not a big issue, but sort of a symbol of how this kind of abuse can run rampant in what should be a nice tax and regulated arrangement.
No, I think you've got it. That's the bottom line here is if cannabis was taxed and regulated, then we would have some leverage for testing the product, to have some basic safety guidelines for the manufacturer of the product. I mean, when's the last time you ever heard someone dying from bathtub gin or bad moonshine?
And in fact, when we look back at the pre-alcohol prohibition times, these weren't a big issue. my grandmother would tell me stories about this Popskull, you know, gin that came out right from the still that would give you a headache so bad, you know, you could hardly recover. And it was, again, because of impurities and a rapid move to try to produce things too quickly in order to make a quick profit. And again, it's so much different in the you know, in the medical cannabis culture, for example, where people take a lot of pride in an excellent product that provides genuine relief of specific symptoms. And if we could have that kind of opportunity for brand loyalty and really a genuine concern about quality, it would really improve things nationwide.
Now, on another subject here, this is something you and I had discussed briefly, but I don't know if we brought it up on the audio stash, had to do with some researchers here that were looking into marijuana addiction, the big term we're hearing lately, marijuana addiction, and how they thought they might treat these addicts with lithium. And I thought I ought to get your opinions on that idea.
It's funny because it just seems like when the cure is worse than the disease, so to speak, I'm stunned that people even thought this was a good idea initially, but these were some researchers in Australia who essentially thought that maybe a rather high dose, 500 milligrams of lithium twice a day, could help people get through cannabis withdrawal. Well, anybody who's bipolar, I don't want to insult or hurt in any way. It can be a very debilitating problem. There are these periods of mania where you're highly irritable or energetic or enthusiastic or incapable of sleep, and then these absolutely debilitating, depressing moments that are long in duration and filled with sleep and concern and sorrow. And lithium genuinely can take the extremes out of those moods so that you're maybe cycling much more like the average person. Lithium, however, can be toxic at certain doses and has to be monitored very carefully, and it has some negative side effects that are nothing to play with, including weight gain, dry mouth, an inability to ejaculate for men, and sort of a blunted range of emotion, which can be troublesome when folks who don't have bipolar disorder take it. As we've talked about time and again, marijuana withdrawal, if it exists at all, is a mild decrease in hunger, a slight irritability, and a craving for pot. I mean, what a surprise. This is the horrid withdrawal we're talking about. And the notion that we'd go on a drug that has markedly worse side effects in order to get over what is essentially equivalent to, say, the withdrawal we get from caffeine is just nuts to me. And so I'd really like to see work like this take a back seat. And instead, let's talk about behavioral ways to handle decreasing cannabis use so that withdrawal is minimal, and instead focusing on problems rather than use. This idea that, oh, everybody needs to quit cold turkey and turn it over to their higher power or something immediately may not be the most adaptive approach to decreasing cannabis problems. Often cannabis problems are more about negative consequences from using in inappropriate environments or from using more than you planned on it or something like that. I know it's going to get me nailed to the cross on the cover of People magazine, but in fact, a lot of these people later in life learn to use less often in smaller quantities rather than quit cold turkey and still seem to avoid negative consequences. So I think that's the way this kind of work ought to go.
Well, on the bright side, if someone had a problem with marijuana addiction and then treated it with lithium and suffered all the side effects from lithium, they could use medical marijuana to treat those side effects.
And I'm sure they'd be happy to.
Get ourselves a never-ending cycle there. You know, when I first read that story about giving lithium to treat pot addicts, I was thinking, doesn't every pot addict have a copy of the lithium CD in their collection already? I mean, Nirvana's pretty popular with the marijuana crowd. Oh, boy. Well, we'll keep on top of all of these crazy reefer madness allegations and the latest studies every Wednesday with Dr. Earlywine here on The Stash. And Dr. Earlywine, happy 420 weekend to you.
Oh, and a happy 420 to you, Russ.
And we'll talk to you again next weekend. Thanks for joining us.